Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Imagine being able to sell your business for $5, $10, $20, $30 million. Well, it's going to be tough. And today we're going to go through a checklist of how to sell your business, or if you want to buy a business, what to do, what to think about when buying a business, because this is a seller's market. There's a lot of money out there wanting to buy your business. And today I talked to my friend Christian Muntean, a coaching client of mine, who is the expert in exiting a business for a big multiple of millions. So let's jump into the show today and avoid the big bombs that could go off in your business while trying to sell it so that you keep the money that you deserve from all the hard work that you've done. I'm Craig Valentine. Welcome to this episode of Early to Rise Radio, and let's show you how to make the money. All right, Christian, welcome to the show. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Hey, Craig, it's good to be here.
All right. So, Christian, quickly, what are the names of your two books?
My first book is The Conflict in Leadership. And the second book is The Successful New CEO.
Yeah, that's an exciting one there. You know, I just read that recently, and there's some, you know, so much is super valuable to me and then also to a lot of my coaching clients. Now, here's the thing is I know you very well, and I know that you have an amazing backstory. So I want to know, how did you go from peacekeeping missions in, was the Balkans, right? Over there?
Balkans and, well, I was doing international disaster relief work, and the peacekeeping part was a peace-building research I was doing in southern Sudan.
Okay, so how did you go from disaster relief all over the world to being a world leader in the exit strategies for business and corporate leadership and doing that while living in Alaska?
Yeah, well, the living in Alaska part's the easiest to answer, I guess. It's just because it's where I was raised and it's where I've settled, so that's that part is just because it's home. I got into it because in my work in disaster relief and community development, I started to realize that successful teams or successful projects were always dependent on or closely related to the effectiveness of the leaders on the team and the quality of team life. And it was the same thing in the communities that we worked in. If we were in a community that was trying to rebuild after a disaster or a war, if they had leaders that really cared about the community and really worked hard and did the right leadership things, the community was going to do well. But if they had leaders that weren't doing that, it would perpetually struggle. And so I became very passionate about leadership, and that just led to kind of one thing after the other of me getting drawn into the world of consulting. So I've been doing it about 18 years now, and getting into the exit planning, kind of the short story there is I just started noticing that more and more of my clients and the people I worked with were exploring questions of succession and exit. And it was just a need that I saw. And I later learned, at least in the United States, that 75% of all businesses are owned by baby boomers who are looking at exit or succession. So I realized, oh, this is just where the whole kind of market has shifted or demography has shifted, and most people aren't really paying attention to it.
Yeah, and it's an exciting opportunity that we'll dive into in a bit. Now you're an expert in two areas that are so valuable to a business and that, you know, any business owner is going to be thinking about at some point, which is leadership and then the exit strategies, you know, actually selling the business. You know, what am I going to do when I'm 55, 60, you know, whenever age they want to sell the business. Let's just talk about leadership for a second here. And, you know, maybe using a story of a successful rebuild from disaster, what are like some of the common characteristics of good leaders, aside from caring for the community and the situation? There probably is a little bit more to it there. So what did you see like that was in that aspect that then carried over and you also saw it in corporate leadership?
Sure. That's a great question. And there's a lot of ways to answer it, kind of depending on you know, the situation. And the hope for a listener in that is that there's no one type of leader or one type of leadership. So if you don't fit a certain mold, you don't have to worry about it. But I would say some very common characteristics is that effective leaders are pretty passionate people, and they care about their vision that they have. They have a clear vision, and they care about their people. And those two qualities are not going to float a boat all on their own, but they'll take you a very long way. I would say that a leader who is unable to inspire a shared vision and doesn't have a vision can't lead anywhere. And a leader who doesn't really know how to encourage people and work with people and pull people together has no one to lead. And so those two qualities, I think, have to exist for successful leadership. And then maybe the third is in leadership academia, they just call it active leadership, which is common sense to a lot of people, but you actually have to do something. You can't just have the title of I'm the owner, or I'm the president or the CEO. You actually have to do the work of leadership, which comes as a surprise to many people who in small businesses, oftentimes the leaders come out of a technical background. They're a great engineer. They're a great something or other. And, but they don't understand, oh, I need to actually lead too. And that's a whole different skill set and set of activities that you have to engage in. And if you do that, oftentimes your leadership will work, even if you're figuring things out.
When somebody says, you know, leadership and being passionate, you know, to an introvert like me, I go, oh, you know, I'm sure I'm passionate about what I do, but I'm not going to go and fire everybody up every day. Can I be a great leader? What's the situation around that?
Well, so one of the reasons I have put the effort into getting to know you and build this relationship is because there are some elements of your personality and approach that I identified with, one of which is being an introvert and that. And so, and being in leadership roles and being dynamic and having a lot of ways that you engage publicly. And so I would say you are clearly passionate about what you do. And I don't think it has to be expressed through some kind of onstage dynamism that's very flamboyant or, yeah. People are not, they're not really looking for that. And that can exist without actually providing leadership. You can have a charismatic person, someone who's able to draw the attention of everybody in the crowd, they're able to hold their attention, but they've got nowhere to go, or they don't know how to connect the dots between here and there. And so that's pretty common, actually. And so interestingly enough, you'll find that many thought leaders, many very effective leaders, are pretty introverted people, to be honest. Many of them are kind of socially awkward. It's interesting because you meet them and they're just very articulate speakers. They've got really great thoughts. And then you try to talk to them and it's just a hard conversation. And I don't think that's abnormal. So I, again, that the encouragement in that should be, there isn't really a personality type necessarily that is a leader and other personalities can't. It's more of, are you willing to do certain things? And honestly, if there's nothing that wakes you up in the morning and gets you excited about the future, then I think you just have to ask the question, what are you leading towards? And I've met so there was research done by Jim Collins on Good to Great. A lot of people are familiar with it. And one of the early findings that came out of that research was that the leaders of these most successful companies were not that dynamic of people individually. And so, I mean, that demonstrated that being able to be an effective leader and having this real powerful dynamism aren't necessarily the same thing.
Yeah. I remember when my friend Joe Polish had Richard Branson speak at one of his events, and Richard Branson is kind of socially awkward. Like, he's not actually that great of a speaker, and, you know, he's a fun guy, but he isn't what you would think that Richard Branson would be in order to obviously lead that company. So were there any leaders that you met during, you know, your disaster relief stuff who were just shocked you with how effective they were based on like your first impression of them?
Yes. When I was in Kosovo in the Balkans, so I was there in 2001, directly after the NATO intervention. So I was there as part of rebuilding. So 80, 90% of all the homes in that part of Kosovo had been destroyed in the war and in the conflict. And it was just severely, it's considered one of the most effective, if you want to use that language, ethnic cleansing campaigns that's ever taken place, where the Kosovar Albanians were pushed out by the Serbs. So I was, one of my early projects was to help, and it's like a lot of things when you get in disaster relief work where you kind of get stuck doing jobs you didn't expect. So I was asked to build a therapeutic preschool and start up a therapeutic preschool program in a number of locations. And so I was given this community, which, it would be they call it the Egyptian or Ashkali community. They were, it's what we would call gypsies, but that's kind of a often used as a derogatory term.
Sure.
Just so people understand who I'm talking about. And it's a community of people that very marginalized within a larger, very marginalized community. Like they were the kind of the wrong group to be in terms of like having any advantages in the community. And so I was asked to go up, build or help start a preschool there. And there was a leader in the community. His name was Métis, and he's just a rough looking guy. He was just kind of dirty. Always had a half beard, you know, heavy guy, belly hanging out, just kind of fit the stereotype of a poor, big personality person. And, so I told him what I wanted to do, and I didn't want to create a scenario where they would become dependent on us for resources, because if I was going to start a school, I wanted it to be sustainable without us perpetually putting money into it, because I knew that we had kind of a one-shot funding, and after that, it was going to be over, and so the community needed to be able to hold this. And so I just sat down and explained where we were at and what we needed to do and what we wanted to accomplish. He got super excited. My next meeting with him, he had found us a classroom. He had sourced all of the desks. He had sourced a lot of the materials. And so out of this poor community where literally there was sewage running down the street, 90 some percent illiteracy rate, most people didn't have jobs in the 90% rate, he was able to put a lot of the classroom together just out of his resourcefulness and out of making it happen. And that was something I saw with him consistently, is he did not have resources, but he really cared about his community and he was willing to work. And he just didn't come across, he was not somebody, literally you could not bring him to the larger kind of political meetings where we would meet with the other leaders in the larger city. But if you needed something done in his community, you had to talk to him because he could get things done.
Well, that's fascinating. Sorry, what was that?
Does that help answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And Bedros has a great phrase, if you don't have resources, become resourceful. And it sounds like that's exactly what this gentleman was doing.
Yeah, he knew how to pull them together.
That's amazing. So you go from there back to Alaska and get into, you know, the leadership training and the corporate stuff. What was the transition there? And what got you excited about helping people with the exits?
Yeah, so the transition was, is in community development, when you're trying to engage the interest of a community and you're trying to solve problems in a community and you're trying to work through things, you just learn a lot of tools that help you have these conversations. And I didn't know anything about the world of organizational development or management consulting. It was all unknown to me. But I remember thinking, wow, so many organizations I work with are like little communities. And if we use these tools in these organizations, they would probably operate a lot better because a lot of them are not operating that well. And so I initially wanted to focus on, you know, little nonprofits and small governments and help them be more successful, which is where I started for a number of years. But then over time, I just started to get called on more and more by businesses and corporations as well. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, I just started noticing that it became a normal part of those conversations where I'd be hired to work with strategy or I'd be hired to work with a coaching situation or something. And always in the background, or frequently in the background, there was some kind of a secession or exit dynamic. And I just began to realize that I wanted to, if I was going to serve my clients well, I needed to understand this dynamic that I was encountering so often, because they didn't seem to understand it very well and they weren't preparing for it. And so that's kind of the short version of how I got into that.
Fascinating. So then, speaking of preparing for something, you talk about the silver tsunami, and I'm guessing that's related to the baby boomer situation that you mentioned before. So why is buying and selling a business such a hot topic these days?
It's because there's so much activity there. There's so much going on. So as I said, 75% of businesses in the United States, at least, are owned by baby boomers, according to the Census Bureau and the Small Business Administration. Particularly with this whole 2020 COVID dynamic, it has sped up the clock on the amount of owners who want to get out of their business. There's a very high concentration of older owners that just want to get out. They want to cash out. They don't want to ride the roller coaster anymore. And so there's that whole pressure of supply of businesses, you could say, that are coming onto the market, which is generating that. Additionally, there's probably, and I don't know if I can verify this exactly, but there's possibly more private capital on the market now than ever before. And if it's not,
there's money everywhere, that's for sure.
Very high amount. Yeah, there's a high amount. And I'm not talking about anything related to, this was true previous to all the stimulus money and all of that. There's a lot of private money in private owners' hands where they're looking for a place to park that money. They're looking for good investments, and many of them want to buy businesses. The challenge and the opportunity for people is that almost none of the businesses that are trying to sell, in fact, you know, for businesses under about 5 million or so in revenue, only about 20% of them statistically will ever find a buyer. And that goes up to about 30% for businesses that are doing, you know, like 10 or 20 million.
Really?
Yeah, it's a very low, and the reasons are not magical, or it's not just luck or chance. It's really, they're just not doing certain things that make themselves attractive to buyers and ready to sell. They're just not doing it.
Yeah.
And they take an example. I was talking with the owners of, or the owner of a company. It does around $35 million a year. It has a average of about between $7 to $9 million EBITDA every year. So that's basically a way of calculating EBITDA, is a way of calculating profit. Two owners. So these guys are doing great. And in many ways, it's a very well-run business in terms of its revenues and in terms of very high profitability. They would like to sell. They cannot find a buyer. And the reason is there's just certain pieces that they don't have in place in their business that when buyers come and look at them, they immediately say, no, this isn't going to work. And that's very common. It's what happens most of the time. And it's a shock to buyers to find out that their baby is not as pretty to everyone else, or to sellers to find out their baby is not as pretty as they thought, at least not to everyone else.
What are some of those common mistakes that the entrepreneurs have done? Is it around leadership, management, accounting, something else?
Yeah, it's one of the most common ones is dependence on the owners. So there's somehow the owner of the company, particularly in smaller companies, but even this can go up to tens of millions and possibly higher depending on what somebody's built. But just dependence on the owner, where somehow the owner is still integral to the success and operations of the company. And because you can't buy the owner, you're buying the owner out, not buying the owner. The other part that's really associated to that is dependence on maybe a key manager or a key brain in the company. And so there's somebody in the company who understands the magic sauce of the company and no one else really can figure it out. Or there's a manager or management team or supervisor who've, you know, they've been with this owner for 30 years and they plan on retiring with the owner. And so you lose these key elements if you don't have anything behind that. A buyer will look at that and say, I'm going to have to rebuild the entire management team. I don't know if we could survive that. The other element that's very common is, I guess you could say it's poor financial controls or financial management. An inability to produce a financial statement, like on command, your at least last month's financial statement, and the not having financial management systems in place. I cannot tell you how frequently I'll work with fairly high dollar businesses in the small business space, but there's complexity enough that you can't just track it intuitively. You know, that it's, there's more money moving around than that. And an owner will tell me about how they just discovered, because they're getting ready for a bank loan, or they're getting ready for a, you know, a buyer was doing due diligence or something like that, that a trusted somebody who was doing their bookkeeping had just embezzled them for, you know, enormous amounts of money. And it's common. And this is not to like create distrust for bookkeepers, but oftentimes these bookkeepers were not bookkeepers. They were somebody who they thought was good with computers or who was interested in doing the books. And this is, it's actually more common than not to meet a successful business owner who looks like they have it all together. And then it turns out that they cannot produce a financial statement. They don't run their business based off of their financials. Their financial controls are based off of kind of gut feelings and where they what they happen to have in cash in the bank at the moment. And a buyer is going to probably walk away from that. It's just like meeting somebody on a first date and they're drunk. It's just like, I'm not going to deal with it.
That's fascinating. So what are the things that, you know, like the people listening to this podcast generally are in that 3-5 million, want to grow to 10, 20. We have some clients that are 30 million and are looking to position themselves properly for selling in it. And it's not something you do overnight. So how does somebody get their house in order?
Yeah. So, well, it depends on their starting point. So, I mean, I'll provide some basic ideas, but it depends on where you're starting. But I would say, but I don't know if you're comfortable with me sharing like some of the resources I have.
Yeah, please do. Please.
Yeah. So if people go to my website, christianmuntine.com, I can send you the links to this later, but there's a link on there to the Value Builder system. And you can take for free, you can take the Value Builder assessment that's on there, and it will show any owner exactly what they need to do to work in their business or to build value in their business. But I would say some of the most common things include, well, let me frame it this way. If an owner, regardless of them feeling like, you know, do I want to exit now, or is that maybe 15 years from now? If you take the word exit out and you say, I want freedom, because most owners will say, yeah, I do want freedom. I don't know if I want to exit. I do know I want freedom. I want freedom for discretionary time, whether it's in the business or out of the business. I want to be able to do what I want to be able to do and not have to do things. That's why most people, it's a big driver for why people get into entrepreneurialism. But most entrepreneurs discover that you're your own worst boss and you enslave yourself to your job. I mean, that's kind of the dynamic. So if you use freedom as a primary goal and you build a company that allows you to go away for 3 months, take a vacation with your family and not have to be there, and your business will still do well and maybe even grow in your absence, that on its own is a business that will probably also sell for a high multiple or a high amount. And it'll be attractive to a buyer because you don't have to be there. The second part is probably building this financial structure in the company so that you can produce financial statements, increasing your financial literacy to the point where you at least have, or you have somebody on staff or a fractional CFO of some kind who can help you use your financials to manage your business and run it. Those are skills that you may feel like that I've been very successful without them, but by putting those structures in place, because no buyer can buy your intuition. And so they need to be able to buy something. They're going to want to look at what you've got on paper, and they're going to want to see this on paper. Another big thing that's is tricky is people. I wrote an article once for Forbes, and it basically compared, like, why is it that a McDonald's in your neighborhood is going to sell for far more than maybe this 5-star restaurant that's right next to it, that's the local favorite, that's packed out all the time, that you have to schedule for reservations far in advance. Many people that are brokers or M&A people actually don't even like working with restaurants because they often don't sell or don't sell well. Mm-hmm. And many restaurants, when you notice they sell and they go under new management, they collapse and they actually fail shortly afterwards. And it's because the McDonald's is a business in a box. It has all of its processes and systems lined out. So somebody who doesn't know anything about burgers can buy it and produce the same burgers here that you're getting anywhere else in the world. And it's maybe not, you know, the sexiest food in the world, but it's a business that is defined and all of the instructions are there. The high-end fancy restaurant that's operated by the chef, everything's in that chef's brain. And when the chef sells the restaurant and moves on, the guts, the heart, the soul, the secret sauce of the restaurant go with that chef in terms of how you run the front of the house, how you manage everything, all of that. And people don't put enough weight on the unsexy stuff of having good policy, good procedures, and kind of mapping that out. And a buyer will look at that and say, I'll give you hard money to take what's in your brain or what's on sticky notes and actually write it out, and it'll actually move your business. It can move a multiple or a couple of multiples, depending on how well you do that.
Because it seems like it's a buyer's market in that, okay, you have all these baby boomers who want to unload a business. So time is not on their side. And there's a lot more businesses than there are buyers. And then there's going to be a lot of flaws in these things. What type of multiple can a good business expect to command? And how do you, what are Christian's secret sauces for, taking somebody from a 3X to an 8X or even more?
Right. So those are a couple of questions in there. One was, how do you expand your multiple?
Yeah.
And the other one, well, I want to comment on the first one. It's actually, interestingly enough, right now, it's a seller's market because there's so much money looking for a home sitting out there that a lot of people are willing to pay abnormally high multiples, but only if your business is deserving of it. So as I said, most businesses never find a buyer at all. So even like in my work, if I can take a business from what's called non-sellable, like nobody will buy you, to any kind of sellable, a one multiple or a half of a multiple, that on its own is a big jump for that owner who before maybe was just looking at a liquidation. That was the best they could do.
Got it.
And so there's...
Well, actually, first, Christian, let us define... what does it mean to sell at a multiple or a half multiple or a 3X multiple or an 8X right. multiple to people that have never even thought about selling a business or maybe not owning one yet?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give a imprecise definition of the what a multiple is. And but it's kind of a good working definition. You can imagine that somebody's really, when they buy your business, they're buying your stuff. So if you have a building, if you have widget machines, they're buying that stuff. They can't really buy the people, but they can buy the processes. So if you have intellectual property in your business, like processes, manuals, if you have patents, if you have special technology that's unique to you, they can buy things like that. There's other things as well that can add value. But what you're paying for is the idea of what revenue am I likely to earn and make because of what I'm buying right now. So a way to look at a multiple, and this is not precise, but it's a good working understanding. It's kind of like, how many years of revenue can I sell somebody? So if I can only sell for a one multiple, it's like I can sell for next year's profit. Like basically that's what my business, if I walk away from it right now, it's gonna kind of collapse. But if I do a few things, maybe I can get that multiple up to one. And so when I sell, I can sell all my stuff plus maybe next year's profit.
Okay.
Getting up to like an 8 multiple is a very high multiple, which is not uncommon though. If people, maybe uncommon is the wrong word. It's not unachievable depending on the industry that you're in and depending on how well you've built your company. So if you have a company where you can say, hey, I just saw a great deal and I'm going to go to Hawaii or the Caribbean, and I'm going to be gone for 4 months, and your company can operate fine without you, you probably are positioned to have this higher multiple. All of the things that it would take to do that. And again, if you want to know specifically what you need to work on, I would recommend going to my website, because you can actually take it takes like 12, 15 minutes to answer a few questions, and it'll give you a ballpark on this is where I need to focus. This is what I need to do. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And I think it's very important, like that litmus test of, can you go away? You know, can you get sick and go, you know, like if you got sick today, what would happen to the business? And for most of us, we want to say we're business owners, but at the end of the day, a lot of us have high paying jobs.
Exactly. Or hopefully you're right. Matt, right?
Right.
And part of the thing that most business owners, they've been running their businesses. Let's say they are a baby boomer, but even if not, you know, people have this, you know, most people operate life with kind of a myth of immortality. I'm not going to die and I'm going to decide how the future looks. Unfortunately, most business owners don't leave at the timing or the terms of their choosing. Most business owners are forced out by death, like they die or somebody in their family dies or a partner dies and they just can't handle it and they get pushed out. There's a divorce of some kind. It doesn't even have to be their divorce. It could be a partner's divorce that just sends enough ripple effects out that it shakes out the business. Mm-hmm. There could be a sickness of some kind. They get sick, a spouse, family member gets sick, some kind of disagreement or burnout. Those are the top five reasons that push people out of a business. And so what I recommend is that business owners take time, even if you're saying, hey, I'm 30 years old. I love what I do. I want to do this for another 20 years. Exit just seems like this far off thing. I would recommend building for freedom because you don't really know when you're going to need or want to pull the cord. The reality is you just don't know. And something that's happening right now is many companies are getting offers from national or international companies that are buying up smaller, similar or synergistic firms or businesses saying, hey, we'd like to, you know, we'd be interested to come by and talk to you. We buy companies like yours usually for like $10 to $15 million. And the owner's super excited. They're like, wow, that sounds great. I thought my business was worth five. And then as they get in the conversation, the potential buyer looks at them and says, oh, you're totally owner dependent. You can't produce a financial statement or your finances are a mess. There's no way to really interpret them. And, you know, all these things. And what happens is they'll just move on to find somebody else. And so what somebody wants to do is begin building these systems in place, building the kinds of structure in place that gives them freedom. Then at any point that they want or need that freedom, they're able to do it without losing value in the business. If I get sick, but I can already leave my business for months at a time, then my sickness isn't going to directly impact the value of the business. But it may be the indicator that says, now it's time for me to hang up.
What does it look like for a business to be bought? Like, you know, someone says, yeah, okay, I sold my business for 3x multiple. Well, what do the payouts actually look like? And what do buying businesses generally expect of the seller? Like, do they expect most company owners to stay on for 2 years? Or is this
it's a good question.
Depend?
It's a good question. And I'll just kind of go back. I'm going to back up just a little bit too. For smaller businesses in that 3 to 5 million revenue space, the most common multiples will be in the 2 to 3 range. So a lot of people hear about the 8, not that you can't get an 8 multiple, it's just very few prepare themselves to do that. And this is assuming that you're part of that 20% that find a buyer at all. And so the which you can do just by following, you know, making sure certain things are in place. I just wanted to put that out there because anybody who does what I do or is affiliated with sellers knows that most sellers believe their business is going to sell for $5 million. You ask them why, and it's because their buddy sold their business for $5 million. And that's the rationale behind it. My business is better run, totally different industry, but mine's got to be worth at least five. Five's a good sounding number. That's what I'm selling it for. And it's not based off of anything other than that. And I would say that's like 80, 90% of the conversations I have with sellers. That's how they start out with valuing their business. In terms of what the process typically looks like, is there's upfront this due diligence process, which is intrusive. It's uncomfortable. It's a little bit of dropping your shorts in front of somebody and kind of showing them everything. And it's a hard process for a lot of owners to go through because they, especially if they haven't prepared, most owners, especially if they've had any success, there's some level of identity and pride that go with that. And now you have somebody who is doing their job by looking for potential weaknesses in the business. they wouldn't even be looking at you if there wasn't strengths there or something of value that they saw. But what they're trying to do is make sure there's no weaknesses that'll kill everything. So you have to go through that process. Assuming there's an offer made and it's financed and all of that, typically what happens is, and this can be structured in many different ways, but if you have a third party buyer, which means somebody who's not family, somebody who's not part of your management team, but just somebody out there who just is looking to make an investment in your business, they'll typically offer a certain percentage of the buy up front, and it depends on how well structured and set up your business is. It's like most businesses, there will be a smaller percentage up front, and then there's often about a 2, maybe 3 year earnout period, sometimes less, sometimes more, depending on circumstances. What most sellers don't understand or appreciate is that most sellers never earn the earnout, or not all of it. The earnout is usually dependent on performance, and the seller has to go out and earn the money that they're going to get paid. They have to bring in the clients. They have to now set up the systems. They have to build the management team or whatever it is that the owner has told them. These are the markers that I need you to hit for you to get your earnout. But you're going to do this now as an employee. You're not going to be able to control the company, and we might change some of the things in the company that make it work. And so you put yourself at a disadvantage. So what I always advise my clients is front load your earnout. You're going to have to probably do an earnout period in a normal business. But if you do all of that work up front, which is the same work I would advise anyone who wanted to build value in their business, you increase the chances of being able to define the terms of your sale so you can get most or all of the money up front. You may not have to perform an earnout at all at the end, but you may actually get hired to come back as a consultant just periodically when they need you. They'll pay you to be there to be able to pick your brain. But you only get the ability to negotiate something like that if you've done all of the work on the front end and they've bought a business that can just run without your presence. Does that clarify? So there's a lot of different ways it can look, and it's really to an owner's benefit to start preparing in advance to sell, because the price of the company, the multiple is important, but what's even more important are the terms. Because you can sell your company for 10, they may give you 4 up front, which is nice, you know, assuming you don't have a lot of debt you've got to pay off with that and everything else. But the remaining 6, you may not see it or you may not see much of it if you're not able to hit these marks. And most owners don't choose to sell until somebody's died, somebody's sick, they're burned out, there's some kind of conflict. And so their heart is often, or their health is often not in the game for the earnout period.
And then do you ever see people, I mean, what's the percentage of people that just don't have to be involved once the sale is made? Is it almost very rare, or is it a large percentage of people like are able to just,
that's a great question that I don't have an answer to. I don't know. I would say it's very rare. You don't encounter and you don't overhear many stories of an owner being able to sell their business. Maybe for a very tiny business, like you buy a sandwich shop somewhere and it's, you know, you buy it for $500,000 or something like that. Maybe in that. But, you know, for something that's got more complexity and more moving parts, it's very, very rare that somebody can sell their business for a meaningful multiple. And I'm not talking about some kind of almost just giving the business away, but for a meaningful multiple and doesn't have to do some kind of earnout. I mean, I just talked to a buyer. I was helping a buyer decide on a possible acquisition, which they decided to take. But the condition of the company is it was so underrun or undermanaged that it was actually doing a favor to the seller, honestly, to pay them anything to take the company, because it wouldn't take that much work to just go. But they had some, in their case, what they were really paying for were some contracts with some suppliers and some follow-up service agreements. So there was some pieces to it that had a little bit of value, but the seller actually owed more on the company than what I think it was even worth. And so, but because the seller cared about the employees, I was like, man, this is a negotiation point that you can actually give your employees a, or their employees a soft place to land, but you shouldn't pay them hardly anything because this is a business that you now have to go and build. And so it's, sorry, I can't remember the original question, but it's people often, a lot of sellers just kind of don't really appreciate the dynamic that they're moving into, but the multiple is not so important. That's what it was. Multiple's not, it's important, but the terms are more important. And to be able to negotiate terms that you want, you have to offer something that a buyer really wants and will be very easy for a buyer to run.
Yeah, there's just so many factors in here. Now, I'm going to add, there's another factor to think about, which is the tax implications. So are there ways to strategically set up the sale of a business for the best tax purpose? Like for the, so that you're not, I got 10 million bucks, but four of that's going right back to the government. Is there, how do you help people set it up in the right way?
Yeah, the dollars have wings, especially around liquidation events, they call it. So I'm not a tax professional or advisor, so I can't go very far down that trail. But I would say a couple of things around that. Many sellers discover that they didn't give themselves enough time to position themselves to maximize tax benefits or avoid some of the tax consequences. Many of the tax yes, there are significant tax strategies that you could put into place so that you don't lose 40% of your business. And that's an accurate $10 million sale where Uncle Sam gets $4 million of that is not an unrealistic possibility.
Wow. I just made that number up.
You can lose a lot on a business and depending on how, tax laws change, it's likely to become more aggressive in that as well. And so you do want to have a smart tax strategy and you do want to start setting it up in advance because depending on how your business entity was formed, are you C corporation or S corporation or LLC? Some of those things have an impact and some people want to change from one entity to another. And you can do that, but sometimes it takes a couple of years before the IRS, for example, if you switch from a C corporation to an S corporation, different types of corporation, a little bit different ways of relating to the IRS. You can't actually sell your company within a certain time frame if you've just converted to an S corporation. You can sell your assets like a building, but you can't sell the actual business itself. I might have that wrong. It might be you could sell the business, but not the assets, but you're not allowed basically to do a tax dodge by restructuring your entity is essentially what's going on. And it takes, I think, 2 years or 3 years to have the new entity. And so people that don't know that can find themselves stuck in a corner. Additionally, there's strategies like gifting shares out or things like that, that can begin to, or just for your own personal wealth, ways that you want to manage it. So I would just say, talk to a tax attorney that understands businesses and small businesses in particular. Talk to a financial planner. Particularly one that, understands small businesses and the dynamics. Many financial planners, some of them are amazing at it and they get it, but many of them really understand employees who are taking a percentage of their paycheck every month and putting it into a mutual fund. So that's not the kind of help you need. You need someone that understands this dynamic. Talk to a CPA that, again, understands the dynamic and give you advice. I would say, if you stand to make 10 or 5 or $3 million off of it, it's worth spending some thousands of dollars to build a team of people who give you the right advice, which could make the difference in that kind of a scenario of millions of dollars from the $10 million sale. It could save you an enormous amount of money and heartache.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, earlier you mentioned third-party buyers. Now, what changes when you're selling to a family member? And obviously there's a huge amount of, indirect things you have to deal with there. Like what are some big mistakes that business owners make when they do sell to their children or to a key employee?
In some ways, there's a lot of similarities between selling to family or key employees, but family is usually a more complex dynamic. And I would say the key thing, let's just use family because it's more complex as sort of to answer the question. The the most common, or one of the most common things that I see, is that there's a lot of informality in the business already. You know, people's job descriptions are not really accurate, or they were sort of just written up 15 years ago and haven't been updated, and they don't match what somebody actually does. So there's a lack of clarity around roles, responsibilities, and expectations within the family. And that can create a lot of tension that gets sparked when there's a sale. Also, let's say there's multiple siblings. One of them is running the company. One of them is just working in the company. And a third one's not in the company at all. And so what's fair in terms of selling the company or gifting the company to the family? It's just a tough question that needs to be answered. Does it make sense to do it in thirds? And is there any difference for the people who are building the company versus the person who doesn't have anything to do with the company? And it's a common dynamic that people run into. What I encourage my clients is to define, to take time to have a conversation on what's the difference between being owners, like investors, from being managers or employees, from being family members, and to try in their minds to realize these are three very different roles that are not the same thing. And they often get conflated in a business, in a family business or family enterprise. They all kind of get mushed together. But someone who's an owner in a business and a family member, but not a manager, has a little bit of a different relationship than someone that fills each of those three seats. You know, and however you kind of juggle that or move those around, it's important to have different expectations and understandings for each of those and to separate them out. When mom or pop is the owner and the manager of the business, and mom or pop, it's all like mushed together. But when you start to separate out ownership from management, which is confusing for a lot of entrepreneurs, it does make things easier. But it can be confusing or complicated. So that's one challenge. The other big challenge is not having a way for the kids to actually pay for the business. And so oftentimes what happens is mom or pop say, hey, and this is literal numbers I hear frequently, just pay me $20,000 a month for the rest of my life and we'll be set.
Really?
And so they'll say something like that. And what that does is it means mom or pop are never actually free from the business. Even if they've signed it off and they've handed it all over, on an emotional level, their income for the whole rest of their life is dependent on the performance of their kids. And so they're always going to want to be involved in that or stressed out about the decisions that the kids make. And that will create tension in the family. And so I don't advise those kinds of arrangements, but you want to figure out how are the kids going to buy you out and how do you set that up? So it's very clear, very well defined. And I recommend as clean and as quick of a complete split as possible. Like get all of whatever mom and pop want out of the business financially, get it to them, get it over with, get it done as quick as you can.
Man, that's fascinating. I could ask you a lot more questions. I'm just going to finish with one, Christian. This has been really, really helpful to me personally, and I know will be to our listeners. Now, from everything that you've described there, this is clearly not a, hey, I'm going to sell my business in 90 days and be able to walk away from it. What tends to be the timelines that you work with on the sale of a business that's in decent shape? And are there things that can speed it up? And what tends to slow it down?
Yeah. So the rule of thumb timeline that I use is a year from going to market to actually being able to, now, it could be less, it could be more, depending. And this is also depending on, are you actually going to sell the business? Because again, 80% within this revenue range won't. And they'll find out by having spent a year or 2 years or 3 years trying to find a buyer, and then they'll find out they're not. So you can speed it up by doing the same things that build a high value business. I mean, I use a real simple scale, the things that you do to make you ready to sell, which are things like having good policies in place, having your financial management in place. Those things are things that make you ready to sell. And this is something I didn't bring up before, but it's interesting how this is really important. Many owners, in fact, 70-some% of owners report feeling regret a year after they sell their business and wishing they hadn't done it, even if they had a profitable sale. And the reason is because they didn't have something to go to. They didn't have a personal vision or life or something that they were moving onto. They were just leaving their business. And most owners end up really hating that and regretting it. Yeah. So I would say the first thing you want to do is make sure you know what you want next, whether it's getting into a new business, which is very common, or whatever. You're going to do what you're doing with the grandkids, or you've got some new adventures, or whatever the thing is. That's clear to you. It's compelling, and it fills in your life. Then having the structures in place that make your business ready to sell, you can make it through due diligence and you'll look good. The third is the being attractive to a buyer. Like, what is it that makes a business attractive? Like, you've built a strong business and there's just a lot of market in front of you, or you've got a machine that kind of just operates on its own, or, you know, whatever other dynamics that might be in place. A lot of that has to do with, these are things that can really impact the multiple. Let's say you have a business that really like synergizes with another business well and can actually multiply their potential revenues and profits. And so those kinds of things, those are called strategic buys, where it's not just financially, but because of the nature of the business, there's something unique you offer the buyer that multiplies what they're going to get out of you. And so that becomes a higher negotiation point. So the better you've done to position yourself in that way, the higher the likelihood that you'll have people looking for you and that you'll be able to go through the deal quickly. People screw it up by not being ready. Their finances aren't ready. They'll take 5 months to produce a financial statement and, you know, stuff like that. And it's more common than you think. But
well, I appreciate that. Again, this is super helpful to me on a personal level, and I know it will be for so many people. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to tell people to go to christianmuntin.com, christianmuntin.com, go through the value builder,
value builder assessment
on your website. And then again, the two books that you have, Christian.
The first one's called Conflict and Leadership, and it's how to use conflict to build a healthier team. And the second one is The Successful New CEO. So for somebody that's entering into that position, basically, what do you need to know and how can you help make that a more successful process?
Fantastic. And then contacting you directly through the website, anything else?
Yeah, through the website. My email is also good. So it's christian@christianmuntin.com. And I can send you all of this for your show notes.
We'll be sharing this in an email to everybody at Early to Rise. Man, Christian, this has been fantastic. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about here that you think is very important for people buying or selling a business to know?
Not really. I just think it's a far more complex experience than what a lot of people anticipate. You know, it's kind of like the way a lot of people approach marriage. They're in love. It's going to be awesome. How can it not be awesome? And it turns out to be work. And so which it still can be awesome, but you've got to put the effort into it. And selling a business has some of that same dynamic in it, where it can be extraordinary. It can be the best thing in your life. It can be the thing that absolutely changes your life forever, but you have to prepare for it, and you have to prepare for it in the right way. And just don't underestimate that process, which I guess that's probably the final thought I would put out there.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, my friend. Again,
yeah,
Christian.
No problem.
I expected a great conversation with you, but this is really even exceeded my expectations by an 8x multiple, Christian.
Sounds good.
An 8x multiple, the unicorn 8x. Well, I really appreciate it. Everybody go check out the Value Builder Assessment on christianmuntin.com. Contact Christian if you're in that silver tsunami and ready to move on to something else.
Or even if you're younger. I mean, you don't have to be old.
Certainly.
To get ready for that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So super awesome. Thanks, Christian. And I really look forward to chatting with you again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Take care, Craig.
All right. That was a really, really great episode with Christian. I mean, he did an absolutely fantastic job of unpacking a very complex business situation. So I hope that was able to help you, whether you're selling your business to your kids or whether you're selling your business to a stranger, whether you're making $100,000 from it or $100 million from it. I'd love to know what you thought of today's show. So hit me up on Instagram at RealCraigValentine or email me at support@earlytorise.com. Can't wait to hear from you. And again, check out Christian's resources at christianmontine.com. Go through that value builder assessment. That will be a game changer in your life to set you up for financial freedom. And if you have any recommendations on books or future podcast guests, please let me know on Instagram or through email. And we'll talk to you soon at Early to Rise Radio.